I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Real, honest, and meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Julie Samuels is the executive director of Tech NYC that represents New York's fast-growing entrepreneurial high-tech industry with government, civic institutions, and business, in public policy forums, and with the media. Julie and I sat down this week to talk about the work she does with Tech NYC and the future of tech in our city and beyond. You run New York Tech.
Yeah.
Right? But you started as a lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up in Chicago. I was always really interested in kind of the intersection of originally technology and journalism, actually.
And why?
I don't really know. I had a couple of really great professors in undergrad
who got me
thinking about it.
And were your parents involved in any of this kind of stuff?
My dad's a lawyer, but criminal defense lawyer.
Okay, so very different.
Not
lawyer.
At all. Very
right.
Different. I mean, listen, I was always interested in the internet.
Okay.
Right? I was an early AOL adopter, but not in any technical sense. Not, and I'm still not technical.
Right.
But I was always an early adopter of technology.
Right.
So then I went to college. I went to University of Illinois. I'm very Chicago.
Okay.
Very Chicago. And I ended up with this internship at a place called the National Center for Supercomputing Applications.
So that sort of like hit your high spot.
Kind of accidentally, though. Like with most interesting good things in life, it was I had a professor who told me about this internship. And at National Center for Supercomputing Applications is where Marc Andreessen invented Mosaic, which went on to become Netscape. First graphical web browser, kind of really where the internet went mainstream. So I was really introduced to that kind of hardcore geek culture there.
Did you love it?
I think so. I loved what they were building. They were building stuff that blew your mind. You know, I couldn't believe that this was going to be the future. And I remember, this was the 90s. I remember at the same time I was taking all these journalism classes and kind of I had this vision that newspapers were going to look like a yearbook. Remember those thicker
I do
thicker
remember
stock?
Those thick, yes, yes.
And as you turn the pages, they would, over the course of the day, the words on them would change. That's what I thought it was going to look like.
That's really funny.
It's crazy not to think about.
Yeah, but it's not that crazy to think about.
Right, and actually we weren't.
We could easily build that.
We could I mean, we kind of have that, right?
We could
a tablet.
Yeah, it's a tablet, right? But you could build it with you have different pages.
Yeah, where you turn the pages.
Yeah, 100%. The technology's there.
The technology's there. So that's kind of, that was the vision I had in the late 90s. Oh, this is what the future is going to look like. So I graduated from college. I worked in journalism for a little bit. I worked for a nonprofit here in New York that did some First Amendment work. I was really interested in kind of what I was a little bit ahead of my time, perhaps, really interested in what the First Amendment and storytelling looked like on the internet as a medium.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you were ahead of your time in regards to that. But the reality is I think that the people that have been super successful in the tech world as a whole are the ones that are ahead of their time.
Yeah.
And you think about people that you know that are not in the tech world, like be it through your kids or through other friends from college or whatever, and they say, oh, my God, I just saw this. And you're thinking, I knew this was coming years ago,
right?
You know,
coming.
Right, because you're in the thick of it.
Though I have to tell you, I mean, I think maybe we'll talk a little bit more about this too. I mean, I think that a lot of us who thought we saw some of this coming, even in my wildest dreams, I couldn't imagine how quickly
it was going to happen.
It was going to happen.
Right,
and
right.
And how the wide scale transformation we've seen, which is fascinating. I mean, what, you know,
no, it's fascinating. I mean, I remember Fred told me the story to someone the other day when he did his first investment and they were sitting around the table and they were sitting at Chase at that point because they didn't have offices and they would tell them what they're going to invest in. And I think they were investing in GeoCities. And someone at the table's like, you're putting how much money into like a website? Like, that's insane. This thing is just, this is not going to happen. This internet thing is like a side thing, you know?
Well, I actually think, I mean, that is kind of why the Valley was so successful.
Right.
And I think we can talk a little bit about this, like, New York Valley dichotomy, because I think a lot of those companies that really took off down there took off because the big banks and the big competitors and government weren't paying attention.
Right.
If they had been paying attention,
probably would never have happened.
It would never have happened.
Yes.
That's right.
Right.
Now I think that we're seeing the kind of that pendulum has swung the other way. And now, you know, I think the companies really need to flex those muscles where they work with competitors, where they work with industry, where they work with government. And that's why I'm so, one of many reasons why I'm so bullish on New York.
Well, you think about Facebook, right? Facebook is not a startup.
No.
Facebook is corporate America.
Huge company.
It's a huge company.
It's a huge company.
You know, and so this whole concept of like startup, I'm a startup. It's like, what point are you not a startup?
Well, and I think so much about this too, because I think it's so important that we have policies that actually incentivize startups, right? Like
right.
Real startups.
Right, right, right. So that they're not, you know, these singular organizations
right.
that creates no competition to that's create right. new ideas and new things.
Yeah. Anyway, that was a tangent. I think we can talk more about that.
We can.
I think that's really, I mean, it's core to what I do for a living now. And I think so much about this stuff. I think we live in such an important moment too for those things. But okay, so I went to law school.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be a First Amendment lawyer. I had a really interesting legal career. I worked at two different law firms. I did intellectual property work. I did a lot of music work. I was a music lawyer.
That's interesting.
It was super fun.
Yeah.
But I'm one of these people, I'm sure you come across them all the time. I'm always kind of, I'm a bit of a seeker. I'm a bit of a searcher. I'm always looking for meaning. And the law firm really kind of
didn't
law firm context
you.
Didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
Even with like the most interesting law firm job.
I get it.
Yeah.
I mean, out of all our friends that started in law when we were younger and went on to law school and then became lawyers, I think that one of them stayed.
It's a hard. It's
everyone hard. Left, you know. Yeah. And now we have, you know, lawyers in our lives, obviously, and they're just really good people. You know, I think that I give them a lot of credit for sticking it out all these years.
And I loved law school. And the skills I learned also practicing law have really been incredibly useful.
Well, it makes your brain think a certain way.
A certain way, yeah. Really analytical. And you see things, I think I'm much better at seeing different sides of things. And I think I'm more empathetic for it, too, in many ways, which can be good or bad. But anyway, so I did that for some time. And then I left and I moved to San Francisco to work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And that was awesome. So EFF, for those who don't know, is kind of like the original Internet Freedom Fighters.
Okay.
You know, originally it was mostly lawyers. It's since gone beyond
just
lawyers.
Thing Mark Cuban was involved in?
Yeah. My job there was, I was an attorney there, and I was the Mark Cuban chair to eliminate stupid patents. So I did a lot
of a lot of them still.
There are a lot. It's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem.
It's a humongous problem. It's really bad. And they call them patent trolls for a reason.
Yes.
And that's what they do.
They are trolls.
It's really bad. And it's a really interesting time to work on that work. You know, part of what was going on was there had not been software patents for that long. I think it was 1998 when you could first get a software patent in the United States.
Oh, I know that. Okay.
And there's a lot of debate over whether you should even be able to patent software.
Right. Just like, should you be able to patent a dress pattern?
Or, right. Right.
Or a recipe.
Or copyright. And all these, like, basically, I mean, as this gets back to kind of what has always driven my career to this point, as these things that we've always done move online, how do these laws implicate that? None of our patent or copyright laws were written
with the internet in mind.
Right. So what does that look like? And at EFF, we spent a lot of time thinking about how to not mess that up. You know, how to make sure, for instance, what I worked on there was how to make sure that these intellectual property laws didn't get in the way of innovation, didn't get in the way of creators, didn't take this kind of this promise of the internet that would allow for all different kinds of people
and
to create
it.
All different, right, and stifle it.
And do you think that it's changed since then, or do you think it's even gotten worse?
I definitely think it's changed. I don't think it's
any better. Or it just continues to evolve in different ways.
It definitely continues to evolve in different ways. I think with regard to patents specifically, it's gotten a little bit better because we were able to change some laws. We were quite successful in the Supreme Court over the course of many years. I mean, change is slow and hard and wonky, but it happens.
Particularly in government.
And so the world is better for people who worry about software patents. I think there are other things that make creating on the internet harder. And, you know, those aren't. We live in a world where that is rapidly changing all the time.
Oh, yeah. We live in this world of where everything is changing so quickly. I mean, if you take a completely different vertical like cannabis,
yeah,
right? So I just had a company that was purchased by a Canadian company, and I wanted to just sell enough stock to get the original money back.
Right.
It literally took me, I can't even tell you the amount of paperwork to get this done, you know, to the point where it's just like, do I really care?
Do you even care? Right.
Right. And I talked to the guy and I said, when to confirm the transaction, and he said, I've never seen anything like this in my life.
Really?
And I said, you know, what's so crazy about it is in 10 years, I won't need to do it like this.
Right.
JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, anybody will sell the stock. But now, because it's cannabis, you know, and, you know, they just let like 500 people out in a Mississippi jail the other day, you know, or stupid misdemeanors in the cannabis space. But our government is so behind, where we are going. And I think it's the same thing with these kind of trolls and patents.
That's
and
right.
Where should software be? Because the people that are making these decisions are so dislocated from kind of reality.
How people are using,
yeah,
using the products, living these issues every,
yes,
day. That's right. And I mean, with regard to patents in particular, and this is true with not just patents, but patents I think are illustrative. Our patent system in the United States is a one-size-fits-all system. So we have a set of laws that apply to pharmaceutical patents, to software patents, to patents for other mechanical functions that are all the same. And you know, I don't have to tell you that the market for software is
a little different.
It's so different.
Than a car engine.
Right. So like try and come up with a set of rules and laws that make sense for all of those things.
Very difficult.
It's really hard. In the best case, it's really hard. In our current state of government in DC, it's that much harder.
For sure, because they're interested in just rolling everything back, right, and just having a free-for-all,
yeah, which is that too.
You know, which is not a good thing,
no,
either. So, you know, you were running this thing in San, yeah, Francisco. How long were you in San Francisco?
I wasn't
Francisco
running it.
For?
I was a lawyer there.
You were a lawyer there.
I was in San Francisco for about 5 years, all told.
So you really have an interesting view of the difference between San Francisco and New York.
I do.
So you left San Francisco.
I had already left EFF, and I was running another organization called Engine that works with small startups on public policy issues, mostly in DC at the, mm-hmm, federal level. I was running that in San Francisco. My husband actually founded it, and I was on the board originally. Then we got married. I took over. Long, complicated story. and we had been talking about moving here for a while. I had lived here before. He hadn't.
And where is he from?
South Florida.
Okay. So yeah, is irrelevant.
Yeah. It's not the most exciting place to be from.
So you both took the plunge?
When I got pregnant with my first kid. We
decided you wanted to raise your kid in New York.
Want to raise a kid in New York. I said to him, I remember, if we're going to do this move, let's move while we're two people and not three. And let's do it.
Makes sense.
It was, I mean, by the way, our timing could not have been better. We moved in October of 2014.
Okay.
So we've been here 5 years this time. And I mean, I feel validated by that decision.
Every day.
Every day. And I remember the moment when I kind of stopped to think about it was when my older son got to preschool, and I turned and I looked at my husband and I said, I think we're the only parents who work in tech in this class. And I was like, that's why.
Yeah.
That's why.
So where in New York do you live?
Upper West Side.
Got it.
And we love it. And I love everything about it. For the most, you know, like anything.
Yeah, like anything. No, I totally get it. I mean, we lived in the burbs for 5 years and came back to New York. And there is literally not a day that I don't get up since that 5 year move. Yeah. And that was 20 years ago that I don't get up and say, oh my God, I'm so lucky to live here.
So lucky to live here.
So lucky to live here.
And there are so many, until you actually live here, there are so many things happening, so many little things that might be in your, you know, a block away that you don't even know about.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And the experience now as a parent,
completely,
as an organization. We have a dog. I walk my dog every morning in Central Park. There's like a whole
– there's a whole park situation.
There's a whole park
going on.
Situation.
Totally. So you came – did you come and have that job, or did you get here and then took the job?
I had that job running this organization, Engine, which I'm still very involved with. It's a great organization in San Francisco, and I was still running it when I was here. We moved here in October. I had my kid in March, and in about the following October, I started taking a series of meetings about Tech NYC, which didn't have a name yet, is the organization I started and now run with Fred, of course. Well, Fred doesn't run it. Fred started it with me and a handful of others. And we had a series of conversations with people who've been working in tech for a long time about building an organization that could really speak with one voice for the industry here, for the kind of the companies and investors. And this is what actually happened in October of 2015. I started taking a series of meetings. And I remember at the time saying, I don't think this is actually
for me.
This, I don't think it's going to happen. Like, right. These are some really big personalities I'm dealing with.
Yes, and, yes, for sure.
You know, and there had been efforts in the past to build something like this.
And it never happened.
It never really happened.
It sort of happened in the mid-90s, but it was very so grassrootsy. It just never
kind of caught, right?
It didn't, yeah.
And I had
it was the wrong players, too.
I had a six-month-old. Right. I mean, it was all crazy. But I was like, you know what? I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to take these meetings.
Why not?
What's the harm? It's great for me anyway. And so Fred and Tim Armstrong chair my board. At the beginning, Kevin Ryan, Kevin Sheekey from Bloomberg, Desiree Gruber. That was kind of the core group. And I took this series of meetings after about 6 weeks. And I remember, you know, I woke up one day and I was like, well, I have to quit my other job. This is going to happen now.
Yeah.
And I never really looked back. So I started working on it full time in January of 2016. We publicly launched in May with 40 members. And we now are in, November 2019, we have 800 members.
Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's been crazy.
And so what is it that you are doing for your members? You know, what are they getting out of being part of this organization?
So, the core work that Tech NYC does is really to kind of support the ecosystem at the city and the state level.
Okay.
And that can take a bunch of different forms. I would say I kind of think of the bread and butter, like the pure kind of politics and policy of it. We work with the city and the state, sometimes with them, sometimes fighting.
Right, exactly.
And a various set of policies.
Right.
And the policies we work on either can be policies that impact our members, actually their bottom lines. Like we can talk more about these specifically, but at a high level, like right now there's a lot of debate in Albany around privacy legislation.
Of course.
Or at the city, you know, we might be working on ride sharing or home sharing or whatever the issue of the moment is.
And those issues of the moment, are they something that you know, issues of the moment are a funny thing, right? You're thinking of things in the future, or they're coming across your desk, or you have four companies that say to you, this is a problem for us. Mm-hmm. So, or you're hearing things out of Albany. So how does that sort of rise to the top that there's something you guys get involved in?
Well, it changes. It's a really good question. And, you know, in the 3.5 years the organization has been live, that's changed a lot. I mean, obviously, the politics around tech have changed 180 degrees
completely
in the past 3.5 years.
So
it used to be that we would be, when we first started, I think it was more on us to bring the issues
to everyone.
And
now, so they understood them.
That's right. You know, this is happening. We can do better here. Now, you know, frankly, there's a lot more, I don't want to say playing defense, but playing defense a little bit. You know, the issues are coming hard and fast from the regulators.
And how do we become offensive?
It's a really good question. I think that gets to two other things that Tech NYC spends a lot of time on. One is also identifying issues that we work on that are maybe not directly related to our members' bottom lines, but are issues our members care about. So we were active on the congestion pricing campaign for the MTA. How do we get the subway working better? We have been active on campaigns around voting reform here in New York. We've been active on issues around immigration, not city and state, but federal and incredibly important to our community. So how, and then the other thing also I should say related to that is the other thing we spend a lot of time working on is how we better integrate the tech ecosystem here and its leaders in particular to the existing political and civic structure of the city.
Okay.
Right? How do we make sure that the CEOs of our companies, that the investors, the other leaders, you know the mayor? Do they know the governor? Do they know other important stakeholders and elected officials and policy type people? You know, how do we integrate tech in New York City beyond just the companies? And this is what I think is so important and interesting.
So do I. So, you know, if you think about San Francisco, I think what makes that echo chamber, which is exactly what it is, very unique is that if you are a Stanford student and you've chosen that I'm never leaving this area again, and you grow up in the tech world and you start a company and you go out to play soccer out on the fields is the VC and his family or her family. And then the lawyers are there with their families. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, there's this community. And everywhere you turn, that's all there is. In New York, I've always thought what makes it so unique is that we've got the best and the brightest of every single company, from medicine to fashion to software. I mean, you name it. And we have one foot in tech and one foot in that industry. And you really spend the most of your time now, and even then in the 90s, in your industry.
Right. And so, you all take the subway together.
You all take the subway together.
And you all walk on the sidewalks together. I mean, you cannot avoid – in New York, you cannot avoid – exactly what you're talking about.
No.
Even if you, I mean, you wouldn't live here if you wanted to, but it's impossible. And that, I think, is really going to be the future of big companies. You know, those days of isolation, which while they, I think, were incredibly important for building the tools of the internet that we use. I kind of said this earlier. I think that was a moment in time that actually the Valley was great for having that isolation.
Right. Now,
it's over. It's
over. Well, also, is there any company in the globe that doesn't have a foundation built on a technology so that they
not
can
anymore
talk to the offices, talk with all the people in their company, outside their company, their clients, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what is a tech company?
What is a tech company? I was going to say the exact same thing. What is a tech company?
People ask me all the time. Actually, I get that question all the time. And how do you decide who's going to be a member?
Everybody's a tech company. I mean, I don't even care if you make cookies.
That's right. The thing that all of the companies in our network share is that they need to hire tech talent. And that
is a whole thing in itself.
A whole thing in and of itself.
And do you think that is going to be easier as the kids that are now graduating from colleges are all fluid in technology, even if they didn't take a computer science class?
Yeah, I absolutely think that, you know, and of course, well, and you and Fred are responsible for a lot of the good work that's happening in this regard here in New York City.
Right, with CS4ALL. Yeah, for sure.
Which is truly amazing.
I mean, it is kind of amazing that only, you know, 5 years ago that there was one computer science class in the entire city in Stuyvesant.
And now, I mean, I guess for people who don't know, CS4ALL is this 10-year, $80 million public-private partnership. And in 10 years, there will be computer science education in every New York City public school.
Right, from entry to senior in high school.
Amazing. And, you know, not everyone is going to become an engineer, but like with many things, people will be exposed, and the people who are interested and have an aptitude hopefully will pursue it.
Well, I actually think even when you get to college, instead of taking language, everybody should just take one CS class.
I mean, I think about this often because I think – frankly, I mean, I was really good at math, and I never.
So was I.
And I, the second I was done with my credits in math,
I was done.
Never looked back.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I was
what
amazing
if someone
at math? What if someone said, you know, hey? Although I still remember there was a computer, and that was a long time ago, and how you wrote it, and you know, it was like four geeky guys nobody talked to, it wasn't like something I thought about. Oh, I really want to get involved with these four guys.
I think about, but that's a huge, I mean, for an 18-year-old in college, that's what drives decision making.
That's totally what drives decision making.
It's not the only thing, but
it's a huge piece of it.
It's a piece of it for me at 18.
Yeah. So that's an interesting, and I wonder if we, you know, I mean, I know so many kids who are 25 to 28 that have literally taught themselves how to code.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the price of engineering will come down as we have this complete influx of young minds that are engineers.
I think the price of engineering will come down for two reasons. The first is what you say, you know, there will just be more supply, which will bring the price down.
Right.
And I think there will increasingly be more tools built that make some of the engineering tasks more accessible.
Right. It'll be plug and play.
Yeah. There'll be more, you know, and so you'll always need the really kind of high-end engineers, high-end's probably not the right word, but like the real geniuses.
Yes, the real deep thinkers that are, you know, major IT people.
And you'll need engineers. You know, I think we talk a lot about the future of tech jobs, but we sometimes don't take enough time to think about what the spectrum of those tech jobs look like. And it's a very wide spectrum,
right?
It's, you know, from the PhD in, you know, machine learning or neural networks, who's like deep in it. And you have like QA and all kinds of other IT jobs. And you're looking at everything in between as well.
Right. But then the other part is that the importance of those companies is not just those jobs.
Right.
There's the marketing person.
That's right.
And yes. And the head of HR and all those other components that make a company.
That's right. And those are the jobs of the future of our economy. And, you know, I think I hate to talk about this immediately, but, you know, when we think about what happened with Amazon and HQ2 here in New York, that was the real tragedy in it.
That was such a tragedy. And that was such a, like, political lightweights.
It was a real shit show.
Yeah. I mean, it just.
Can we swear on this podcast?
Yeah, we can totally swear on this podcast. It was just amazing that they were so completely inept and clueless in how they managed that thing.
So it was hard to watch. It was hard to be a part of.
I'm sure. It was, like, no one was looking at the numbers. The numbers were like, it made so much sense.
It made so much sense. And the deal was a good deal. And no one had a real conversation about what incentives really mean. And, you know, we can get in the weeds in that. But the part that drove me the most crazy, the part of the story, and this, by the way, is indicative of, I think, a larger problem we have in our political discourse with regard to tech in particular, is that, you know, the main narrative to me in that instance was you were talking about a part of the city, Long Island City, a part of the country that used to have a ton of manufacturing jobs. It doesn't anymore.
It does not.
Like, everywhere else that used to have a ton of manufacturing jobs, those jobs are gone.
And they're never coming back.
Correct. I don't care who tells you otherwise. Those jobs are not coming back.
Right.
And you are talking about bringing tens of thousands of the next generation of jobs there. That is an amazing thing. That is something that every part of this country
wants
or should want.
Well, also, you know, you're thinking about kids that graduate from high school. They might go to not go to college. They might go to a 2-year college. They might go and learn a trade. But let's say they graduate college. They learn technology. They like to code. They can get a job at Amazon, which is not here. Right. And all of a sudden, you have created, many of those were immigrant kids that, like, it changed the entire family dynamic. Right. Real opportunity. And that, to me, was the thing that was going to be great. All these kids that are going through CS for All then go graduate and couldn't have got a job right there.
Now, listen, you know, by all the reporting and what we understand, Amazon is still probably going to have 10,000 jobs
in New York. Of course they are.
But those jobs are going to be on the west side of Manhattan. They're not going to be in Long Island City.
Right, and they should be in Long Island City.
They should be in Long Island City.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone is capable of having that conversation again.
Well, not that specific piece of it. But it's, I mean, I think a lot of the conversations we're having around tech, and I'm using the word tech in its kind of broadest sense.
It's so broad a sense.
Yeah, is the positive narrative, you know, the kind of the stuff that technology is building and enabling. It has, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of negative externalities. There are a lot of things we need to be thinking really hard about as a society. But there is so much good in there still. There is so much progress in there still. And it is really, if you were, you know, to come from Mars today to the United States and open up, you know, a newspaper on the internet, on a computer, you would not believe that. You know, you would, the narrative out there right now, it's hard to find, especially in the political world in which I spend a lot of time, it is hard to find the stories that remind you
of how important it is.
How important it is.
Well, I think that we just become numb, right? Could you imagine if someone took your ATM card away? Right.
What about your phone?
Right. Your phone?
I mean, the phone is amazing. Think about what is in your pocket.
Right. Think about, you know,
Google Maps?
Yeah. I mean, Google Maps is probably one of the most genius things that have ever happened.
Yeah.
You know, even paying your rent, you don't need to go write a check. Who writes a check?
Oh my God, we have to. I can't talk about it. But it's a long story.
I mean, you know, I mean, all of these things are making a reservation.
Right.
Or booking something online for your travel. I mean, on and on and on and on. Nobody wants to take those things away. Those are all good things.
Those are good things. And again, it's not so simple, but that positive part of the story is, it's so important. And right now it's a little hard to tell.
It is a little hard to tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're in weird times.
Yeah.
We're in very, very weird times. And I think that one of the reasons we're in hard times is because we're all living older.
Yeah.
And so you're having people that are living to be 80, 90, and 100, which is fantastic. Yeah. But the problem is that they really, a lot of them, just as we were saying, like even friends that you know who are like so surprised by things that you saw 8 years ago, it scares them and they don't feel comfortable with it. And they've become more conservative as they've gotten older. And so, you know, we have people that are running our countries that are voting for things that isn't good for the future of America.
You know, I mean, I think it's, we are, it sounds trite, it sounds kind of corny, but it's totally true. Like, we are living in a moment of change, of societal change that is like once a century. It's not once a generation. It's not once a decade. Like, this is a pivotal moment for human beings.
I 100% agree. I mean, I think that when we look back in this last 20 years, you know, it will be, this was the time of change.
Yes.
This was the beginning of the technology revolution, which we are still very much in. But now we're moving into different ways that we're going to live our lives, different ways that we go to work, different ways that we do everything. And we're, you know, even how we're getting carbon footprint and how our food is distributed.
And what our food even is made of.
And what our food is made of. I mean, all of these things, we're going to be in such a different place in 10 years. I just don't think that we will continue to accelerate at that level.
I think we're like at the tip of it, right?
Yes.
I really feel like if anything, the slowing is coming because
it has to.
And change is hard. I mean, you know, for a lot of those people you're talking about who get older and they get more conservative and whatever, like, change is hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, for certain people.
Yeah.
I mean, I love change. Yeah. I could change every day, but most people are not like that.
And that's okay. And especially, you know, the thing about change, of course, is there are going to be winners and losers.
Always.
And, you know, politically, that's what I think you're seeing play out right now.
Oh, well, absolutely. So what would you say is the best piece of legislation or the best thing that, you know, New York Tech has done, that you've done for this community?
That's a really good question. It's so funny because usually we get it from the other side. Like, what is the worst thing that's coming? I'm so glad you asked that version.
I mean, it's a positive thing.
Yeah, I love that. I will actually say that New York has been great for tech, and it's not because of any single piece of legislation, and it's the culture of New York and the culture of New York that has embraced technology, but has also put the companies to held the companies to standards that I don't think they get held to in other, you know, parts.
Oh, they don't. I mean, even the investors have a completely different standard before
it's
they're
harder.
Putting
a penny. It's harder here.
It's harder here.
People actually care about profit and
yes.
have since
have
before
always.
It was cool. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I think the biggest victory is that we haven't screwed that up. And we've worked really hard, I would say, to not screw that up, to make sure that tech is integrated into the city and into the other industries here, and to make sure we're all talking and we're growing together.
Right.
And that has been incredibly rewarding.
I'm sure it has been. And it's also part of the culture of New York.
Yes. It's an easy job. That part of my job is really easy.
Yeah. I mean, it's really part of the culture of New York. If you go back and read any historical books about New York, you know, there was a mixture of people. You know, it could have been the artists, it could have been the chefs, it could have been the people of business. Mm-hmm. It's like they've all always connected in this city.
There's this other thing too going on in tech in New York, and I wonder how long it will last. But as opposed to some of the other large industries here, finance, real estate, you know, tech is still, it's still younger, it's still smaller, and until recently, I'm sure you know this way better than I do because this is your lived experience, people would say, why New York? And a lot of people in tech had to make a choice and explain their choice for being here.
Right. I mean, when Google opened up here, they were like, well, no one's going to even want to live in New York. Right. Now they own like how many buildings?
A lot. Right. Right. And so there's this thing that, and this is part of what I love about my job, is that all of the people in New York who work in tech at some point have made the conscious decision to be here.
Yes.
And so they all love New York. Like, yes. What an amazing thing to start with. A group of people.
That love being here.
That love being here.
Well, the people from San Francisco are now, like, coming down to LA. LA feels very similar to New York did in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. and it's getting and growing. But, you know, I think that the question to why New York is, like, why not?
Right. Where else?
Where else?
Where else?
Where else? Right. Right? I mean, if you're going to make it here, you're going to make
it
in New York.
And New York, I mean, it's hard to live here. It's expensive to live here.
No doubt.
But you've got to want it. And people who are here, they want it. You know, there is not a very large culture. I can think of very few people I know in tech who live in the suburbs. You know, people are here because they chose to be here.
I agree with that.
So I have a question for you, because sure. I know you talk to so many women entrepreneurs. I want to talk a little bit about ambition, and particularly women and ambition. I'm fascinated by what drives women and what those trends look like.
They seem, you know, women are so much different than their male counterparts. You know, I mean, women can have children and men cannot. And that is really a driving force.
Yes.
You know, I mean, some women might choose not to, but there is a time where you're like, I got to have these kids. And although you can put everything on the back burner, you know, put your eggs away in a freezer, you know, all these things that, you know, I don't know how well they all work, right? And there is something to be said about having him young and then having your second life, right? So that you're not 80 years old by the time your kids go off to college.
So I've heard someone said to me something interesting about that, and I can't, that you should either have your kids really young so you can do what you just said, or have them a little bit older, which is what I did. I had mine at 37 and 39. By the time I had my kids, I had a really established career.
Right.
And it has afforded me a lot of flexibility
to do what you need to do.
To do what I need to do.
You know, listen, there's no right answer. I always say, you know, have them young if you can.
Yeah.
Just because of exhaustion. And
which is very real.
Which is very real. Yes. And also, you know, you're not as concerned about a lot of things because you're younger and you're more flexible. But I think that there's a lot of very ambitious women, but I think what they want from their lives might be different than what a male counterpart wants from their lives. And when women build companies, I think they build companies they are passionate about that fill voids in their lives. I'm not so sure many of them go into it with this concept of like, I have this billion-dollar idea. I think it's something they feel super passionate about. And then they realize in time, wow, I could really grow something big with this thing. I can keep going. Then you have others, you know, that walk into a room and they own it and they know they have something big. But it generally takes women a couple times and a couple rounds of financing before they're willing to say, wait a second, I know more than everyone else in this room.
That part has been so hard for me. And I mean, it's different. I run a nonprofit, different context with regard to fundraising, but I think at the level we operate, there's a lot of similarities. And it's taken me a long time to feel confident in that room.
Yeah.
It took me until I was in my 40s to feel confident in that room.
I mean, I have seen so many women who, you know, they couldn't raise the money at the beginning, finally raised the money. They were like so scarred from the experience. And then they went out again because they had to. And they're just like, I just want to get profitable so I never have to do this again. Right. But then the ones that are really growing, they have no choice but to go out and raise money because it's not that they can't be profitable, but they realize if they don't ramp and you don't stick your foot on the gas, you do lose your momentum because there's a time when it starts hitting.
Yep.
You can't like slow it down because when you do,
but if you have
you
young
lose
kids
the success.
At those times, it is.
It's really, really difficult. It's and really hopefully hard. You have a partner at home that is committed and is able to do everything and you're a unit. But it does. It makes it very difficult.
And another thing I don't think we talk a lot about that I wish we did more when we talk about how hard it is. I totally agree on having the right partner and I feel very lucky in that regard. But how much work it takes and how – I don't just mean on the part of, in my instance, my partner and me – I also mean with regard to how much help I have and how much help it takes. And it is not pretty. Like, it is not pretty what it takes us to get through the day.
Well, it's very expensive.
It's incredibly expensive.
Right. Until those kids are in school full time, you know, be it public school or private school, right? Private school costs more money. Public school is public school. You still have to take them to school and pick them up at the end of the day. It's hard. And it's so hard starting a company from scratch and all those years of like, you know, the slog of getting there and getting there and getting there. And I think women, they tend to be not ready to put their foot on the gas. Like they want everything lined up before they hit that gas. And because of that, I do think many women have lost those windows of opportunity that you need to jump through to get to the next side.
Yeah.
Whereas men, like literally, they put their foot on the gas and they never let go.
Is that a confidence thing?
I think it is a confidence thing, and it's a I think it starts from when they're very young, yeah. and how, you know, we treat and train young men and young women, you know, from the time they're in elementary yeah. school. So I don't really know how you change that. You know, we have different, you know, DNAs, obviously.
And I feel lucky. I mean, I feel like I have a lot of options. And I'm very I'm incredibly lucky to have options and to be able to make choices in my life. I think most people in the world don't have that, but it can also be paralyzing.
Yes, it can be paralyzing. It can absolutely be paralyzing. But, you know, I think that you got to follow your heart and yeah. what you want to do and follow what you want out of your life. There's a lot of women that are extremely driven. But I think the question is, what level of drive? What do they want yeah. from their lives?
One of the things I like to think about, too, when I have days that I feel like just, oh, my God, what am I doing? Like, how am I getting – my kids are young, 4.5 and 2. So I'm in the shit right now.
I'm in it.
But I also I realize in the moments of clarity, which are sometimes hard, that it's so important to have a career and to have this piece of myself that is just myself, because my kids aren't going to need me. There's going to be a time in my life where
they will not need you.
Where they won't need me every day. And that's kind of what I put in the back of my head at some of those like those really low moments, which there are low moments often.
Yes. And I think that women have to be able to, that was the greatest thing about the Women's Entrepreneur Conference yeah. is all women could really talk about those things.
It's hard.
It is hard, but you do get to a point where, you know, you look at your lives and your kids are getting older and older and older. And then at one point where they took up 85% of your brain, they're going to take up 10% of your brain. And what are you going to do with the other 90%? Right. And I think that it's important for women to maintain a own personal life with their own egos and their own brains versus just supporting. You know, I think it's great that women who choose yeah. to stay home, but they got to figure out how to show their kids that they are still engaged with society, because that's not good for their kids either.
Yeah, I think there are a lot more opportunities for women now. It used to feel like more all or nothing. And I think now yes. there are a lot more. Like how I have a very full-time job. I work all the time, but I'm also my own boss. And that has been, you know,
huge.
It has been huge. I've never missed a doctor's appointment.
Right. As you shouldn't. By the way, no one should.
Right. Right. No one
Nobody
should
miss
right.
that. Nobody should miss a kid's basketball game.
That's right.
Nobody should miss anything. There is no reason with technology today. I don't care if you work for General Mills or for Foursquare or for a company that has 4 people.
Yeah.
You should be able to have complete flexibility to have a life.
I 100% agree with that statement. But there are obviously and absolutely times where you have to make tough choices. I mean, you know, I have a ton of flexibility and that's great. But the price I paid for that is I never took more than 6 weeks off after I had a kid. You know, I run a small organization.
Right.
And but that's okay.
Sure, that's okay. Because that's okay. A decision you had to make.
Right.
But I don't think that companies are doing themselves a favor yep. by not allowing this generation of workers to have total flexibility in lives. I mean, I see, you know, even, you know, my daughter who works in the tech companies where, you know, she's like, I'm going to spend 2 weeks in California working because I can see my friends out there. Yeah. And they're like, that's fine. I mean, that's amazing, right? Because when I was in school, if someone moved to California, I was never seeing them really again.
Right.
You know, and so that you can keep those connections and keep your life. And if you enjoy traveling, as long as you do your job.
As long as you get it done.
As long as you yeah. get it done. And there will be times where you have to be there in the office.
Yes, but that comes
but
with
in
it.
General, I think technology has done that.
Yeah.
And I think that makes for a better community, a better culture, mm-hmm. better family life, better everything.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, when you think as a society, like, and this is deeper than for this podcast right now, but like, what is the point of work? Like, why, you know?
No one wakes up when they're in their deathbed saying, God, I wish I worked another day. More. But if companies can do that, they'll have better ROI.
Right.
And we'll have a better society. And I think there'll be women that are much mm-hmm. more driven, who are much more interested in tremendous success because they can have yes. that, because they can have both.
They can have both.
Right. And so I think too many women were made to make choices.
That's right. I think that's totally, I totally agree. And I think we could do a better job of, and maybe this is just reflective of the moment I'm in, but I think we could do a better job of telling women, you can have both. And there's going to be a time where it's really hard and that's okay. And it's really messy and that's okay. But you can.
You can.
But you can.
You can. Yeah. You can. And I think there was a time where you could be, you could have children, you could have a job, you could have all these things. You couldn't have them at the same time.
Yeah.
But I do think we're moving, we're almost there where you can have it all. And I think that's really important.
I think so too.
Particularly for women, so that their children see them. Mm-hmm. And because at the end of the day, women have always ruled the world.
Yes.
We just haven't, you know, it has appeared that the men have run the world. And so I think it's important that we show the reality. Show
what it looks like.
What it looks like.
I agree.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for coming.
Oh my
this
God,
was
thanks
fabulous.
Thanks for having me.
And
I could talk about New York and tech all day.
I'm sure you can. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks to Julie for joining me on Positively Gotham Gal this week. If you'd like to learn more about Tech NYC, you can check them out at technyc.org or on Twitter at Tech NYC.